thank you for coming back, Catherine. Although coming back, we just took a 2-minute break. But for our listeners, this is a new week and a new episode. Catherine is here talking about her book, Snow Widows. If you haven't listened to part one, go back and listen to part one and then come back here, because we're just going to pick up kind of where we left off. So Catherine, do you want to take it away?
Yes, I was just looking at a picture that I have on my screen, which is of the figurehead. So that's the wooden figure at the front of the Terra Nova. And that is an image that I've tried to keep in my mind as I've been writing this Greek biography, because it is about five women, but also there are five men, so 10 people. So at least that is just one representative figurehead. And so she was the only woman who was allowed to the Antarctic at this time. No woman had been there, you know, and it would be years and years before that happened. So it's quite interesting. Kathleen Scott said a woman could possibly get to the first hut, you know, just on the edge of the Antarctic Sea, but no further. And earlier this year, Pola Preet got to the South Pole unassisted and solo.
Wow. We've come a long way.
Yeah, we have. We have. She's a lady from London, and she is an army, I think she's a PT instructor. And she just, you know, well, so it's interesting what you can do. And so we don't want to have these limiting ideas of women can't do this and that, because they can. It's, you know, so that's anyway, just from the point of view of making a, you know, so only the wooden figurehead was allowed to the Antarctic in 1910, and now this lady has been right the way to the South Pole.
Yeah, that is awesome.
So that's pretty good. And so you wanted me to talk about the, this her story. So we have the word history with his at the front. And there's a very brilliant book by Richard Cohen, and he has written this book called Making History. And it's also something on BBC Four on the radio. And he talks about women historians. So it starts in 1789 with Lady Mary Wortley.
Oh, I'm a huge fan.
You're a huge fan. Well, I thought you'd be a fan. Exactly. And so his point is that because they weren't given the same educational opportunities as men, they weren't going to write the same type of academic histories. And so she used her father's library, and she wrote about the wives on her travels. And so it's an entirely different narrative and a much more perhaps accessible way of looking at things. And then he talks about Mary Wollstonecraft. So that's in 1759. She was a philosopher and a traveller. I don't know if you know her too, but she wrote A Historical and Moral View of the French Revolution. And she'd had no formal training as a historian, but her narrative is a counterbalance to the normal male narrative. You know, it tells you what was happening on the ground. And that's brilliant. And then the last person he talks about, which is the person that I probably identify with, is Agnes Strickland. And she, in the 1840s, wrote a 12-volume Lives of the Queens. And that founded a whole new school of vivid and utterly readable history. This is what he says, aimed to capture the general reader who felt themselves inadequately served either by the pedantic scholar or the over-imaginative historical novelist. And her writing is anecdotal and engaging, and her research is laborious and very conscientious, but it's a very accessible way of presenting it. And so I would like to think that, you know, this book that I've written is present tense narrative from the point of view of the women. So I've tried to position myself in the evolution of this her story attitude. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I've succeeded, but that has been my aim.
Definitely.
Yeah. And I love the like emphasis on accessibility. I think that's like something that's important to me and Marva too, is like not to like to have something that everyone can understand if they are a historian or not, just like regular people. And it's just so interesting that that's been there in women's writing from the very beginning, in terms of like women's historical writing. Yeah,
absolutely. And from looking at the five women, the quote I really love is from Emily Bowers. And when Apsley Cherry-Garrard wrote a book called The Worst Journey, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it is the best piece of polar writing from that time. And it's about a winter expedition that he, Birdie and Dr. Edward Wilson went on to go and collect penguins' eggs. Because at the time, there was a theory that animals went through all the stages of their evolution as embryos. So they were hoping to be able to find teeth and gills on the penguin embryos to show that they'd been through, you know, through those things. Anyway, so they went on this appalling journey in the winter with temperatures down to minus 60. I mean, ludicrously cold.
Yeah.
Cherry's teeth cracked, his glasses shattered. He wondered if you could, if it was possible to break bones by shivering. You know, it was unbelievably cold. Anyway, he wrote up this story with fantastic kind of witty irony, and it's called The Worst Journey in the World. And he sent it to Emily to say, would you mind if I quoted some of Birdie's diaries in it? And she wrote back and said, I think it's brilliant, but the RGS will think it's too readable. Nothing will be sort of dry enough for that parched up body. And I just think that's what I've aimed to write. I've aimed to write something that's too readable. So it's quite funny, isn't it, that she could see that that they were going to think it was just too easy to read, not academic, not exclusive enough, or sort of excluding enough almost.
It's funny the like lengths people will go to like be exclusive. Like I feel like we were kind of talking about that in like the last episode with like the different like classes and stuff, and like, oh, with Lois, you only get this much money because you're like this class and you have, and your husband had this job and whatever, and you're so like excluded. And then people did the same thing with like information, like as if it's like currency. I've just got to like keep it in the same, the same hands.
Absolutely. You're not as educated as me, so you won't be able to understand this. And so therefore I can kind of, you know, hold the high ground. Absolutely, that's
especially
right.
Especially when it comes to women who didn't have like formal education beyond a certain age. And just, you wouldn't be able to read those kind of things. You wouldn't enjoy reading those kind of things. And it just keeps you like ignorant.
It's quite interesting because one of the themes of this book is communication, obviously. And one of the ways that Taff Evans's father used to communicate was to leave messages in a thing called a dead drop. So you have a post, a colourful post on the shore of Antarctica. And it means that if anybody goes to find your ship, if you disappear, they can go to that post and they can find a metal canister, and in it will be a message saying, we are planning to go to here. So they know where to start searching. Anyway, Taff's father was born the wrong side of the Education Act, which in Britain was 1870. I think that's when it was. So he couldn't read or write, so he signed everything with a mark. So if he wrote a letter to his wife, somebody else had to write it for him, possibly the officer class who could write, and because they had been educated, and then somebody else had to read it to her. Isn't that extraordinary? Isn't that an extraordinary thought that we don't, you know, I don't think anybody's gone into that enough. How did people who couldn't read and write communicate over long distances? Anyway, so, but Taff Evans had been born the right side of the Education Act. So he and his wife, Lois Evans, had learned, you know, the three R's, reading, writing and arithmetic. And Taff's writing particularly is the most beautiful copperplate. He obviously took such pride in writing, and perhaps his parents said, you're so privileged to be able to know how to write because we can't. So every letter that Taff writes is a work of art. It starts at the top of the page, all of it's sort of beautifully written, like print, but copperplate. And he always goes on to the other side because paper was, you know, a kind of a commodity.
Expensive.
And so it's quite an interesting insight. You know, we were talking about in the last episode artifacts and sort of port keys and ways into the past. And just looking at this working class chap writing the most beautiful script, and the sort of more officer class who had had a privileged education just sort of dashed off letters because paper wasn't valuable to them, and they wrote often, and it wasn't a privilege to be able to write. All of their relations could write and read.
And that's like the privilege of communication, like being able to talk to your loved ones more, like when you're away. Yeah, so could we just kind of like do a deep dive into each of the women, kind of their backgrounds? I guess we've like touched on each of them like a bit. There's a missionary, a scientist, an artist, a struggling mother, like landowner, like all these different types of women. But yeah, like if there's anything you kind of haven't told about their stories yet, or their lives after, if any of them remarried, or like Oriana, like got more involved in science after she was like out of her husband's shadow, like all of those kind of like their lives before and after the
Let's start with Kathleen. So Kathleen's mother had died shortly after she gave birth to Kathleen. So she had no mother. She basically grew up being passed between other members of her family. And eventually she ended up in a, she calls it a cheap convent. Actually, it was almost an orphanage. And it was run by nuns who required the girls to bathe in shifts. So they had a very thin cotton nightie on, lest they catch sight of their own naked body.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? So anyway, she grew up.
And these are children, right?
These like, are children. Is... Absolutely children. You know, 7 and 8 year olds. Anyway, so then if you kind of go forward, she went to study sculpture under Rodin. And when she was at a studio called Colarossi Studio in Paris, when she was learning sculpture, she went in and she could see that everybody in the room was looking in a particular direction. So she sort of joined the crowd and looked at what they were looking at. And she saw a nude man walk along and then get up onto a throne and strike a pose. And she couldn't believe that she was looking not only at a naked body, but a man. And, you know, it was just that the model for the day was being chosen. That's, they were in a sculpture studio, that you know. But she was so appalled that she ran to the loo and was sick.
Oh, no.
Because she had been taught that you couldn't even look at your own naked body. So this
That's
is...
a culture shock.
Isn't this extraordinary? So then, if you then scroll forward quite a long way, she... has done an amazing sculpture of a naked man. Actually, it's Lawrence of Arabia's brother, and it's outside the Scott Polar Institute. And her idea was that, you know, you shouldn't see the nude as anything kind of sexual. It was just a beautiful form and light and shade and sort of musculature, and it was just the most beautiful thing that you could make of art, you know, that lots of men had done, have done beautiful naked women, you know, all artists throughout history, haven't they? And so she made these naked men, and she just made lots of statues of men that were naked. And I'm sure that it can be traced back to this sort of early extraordinary requirement to bathe in a shift and then, you know, go straight to Paris and start sculpting nude men. But anyway, so she,
traumatizing.
And I have tried to write the story that she was always trying to literally build the perfect man. So she wanted Scott to be the perfect man. And for her, that was the heroic explorer. So she was sort of investing all her creative energy and support and intelligence into creating the perfect man. That was sort of the way she sort of saw it.
Which this is honestly really refreshing, I feel like, because so much of history, and it's like it's sculpture and literature, is like men trying to create the perfect woman and like their kind of fantasy of the perfect woman, like, and this is like a woman doing that. It's really cool to see, especially like materially, like in sculpture.
It was absolutely extraordinary. And at the end of her life, there's a art historian in New Zealand called Mark Stoker, and he has said she was probably the most important and prolific sculptress after Barbara Hepworth, and she just hasn't been well, you know, recognised sufficiently. She really was an extremely talented woman. And because of her very high profile, particularly after the tragedy, she has sculpted most of the major male figures of the history of her time. So George Bernard Shaw, Lloyd George, Asquith, you know, all these kind of very, very amazing people. And as a result of that, she had them in her studio. So she has had these incredible conversations with people who are making policy. And because, for example, Herbert Asquith, well, a lot of men fell in love with her. I mean, really desperately in love with her. And Asquith used to come out of Parliament when he was Prime Minister during the war and just drive straight to her house. And he was there kind of every other day using her as a sounding board. And, it was the most extraordinary relationship. But bear in mind that, as we said in the last episode, she was anti-suffrage. So when Asquith said, well, should we give women the vote? She said, no, don't do that.
Oh, no.
So she was so talking to these influential people, quite. Mm-hmm. But in a way, it's quite interesting because when she first met Scott, she said she was at a meeting, an artistic salon in London run by Mabel Beardsley, who's Aubrey Beardsley's sister. And she could see this naval captain further up the table. She was sitting between J.M. Barrie and another writer, and she could see this man up the other end of the table, and she saw him ask his neighbour who she was, and the woman, Mabel Beardsley, looked at her and said, "She's nobody," and she could lip read that. And so by the end of her life, she was absolutely somebody. Everybody knew who she was. She was the confidant of prime ministers. She was, you know, with all the major sort of arts figures of the time, she was a very close friend. So it's quite interesting how empowered she became.
Yeah, that is so harsh. But also, if this was a movie, that would have been her, like, turning point, like, climax of the movie. She's like, she's nobody.
Yeah.
I can see it.
Yeah. Doesn't it feel like a movie?
Uh-huh, yeah, really.
You can sort of see it, you know, it's amazing.
And I was just going to ask, are any of her sculptures, like, still around? Can you see them around?
Yes, absolutely. So there's one outside the Scott Polar Research Institute, which is this brother of Sir Lawrence of Arabia, and he is completely nude and standing with his arms out, looking up at the sky. And the people who... It's Frank Debenham, the chap who injured his knee and became director of the Scott Polar Institute, was really embarrassed that Kathleen Scott donated this, partly because it was a nude man and the man was a friend of his and a professor at the university, and he had to bicycle past his naked self every time he was going to a lecture. That was part of it, sorry to stutter. And the part of it was that, you know, it was this man giving himself up, you know, this sort of image of sacrifice right next to the Scott Polar Institute, and they were trying to make the Scott Polar Institute a scientific thing and not to associate it with sacrifice. Another wonderful sculpture that she did is in Waterloo Place in London, and that is on a granite plinth, and it's in the story, part of the story after the tragedy, the news of the tragedy came back, is that they are saying, should we ask Kathleen Scott to do a sculpture of her own husband? You know, is that a kind of decent thing to do because he's just died? You know, is it? And but Kathleen Scott wanted to do it, but she said she was going to put him in sledging clothes. And all the sort of establishment admirals said, no. If, you know, he's got to be in proper naval uniform. We don't want a kind of chap in working clothes on a plinth in London. That's going to be completely letting the side down. And she said, no, he doesn't need props. He can be in sledging clothes and he will still be seen as a hero. So she made this amazing sculpture. But the incredible thing is that she made that one of metal. But then because the war happened, she was asked to make a replica for New Zealand. But at the time, they couldn't make it of metal because they needed the metal for guns. So instead, during the war, and this gives you an idea of the kind of you know, girl she was, she went to Carrara in Italy and she sculpted in marble the same statue that she'd done in London, but in marble. And it was sent out to New Zealand. And that is a beautiful statue in New Zealand. It's a white marble statue, but the same pose as in London. And it's quite interesting. There's so many lovely stories about Catherine Scott. I will move on after this. But while she was in the quarry, she was just kind of walking home to wherever she was staying, some sort of, you know, I don't know, equivalent of a bed and breakfast. And she passed a little statuette of an incomplete angel. But everybody else from the quarry had gone home. So she decided that she would finish this statue of the angel because maybe the legend would grow up that the angel just came out of the stone complete. So she finished off this sculpture and then never told anybody about it. And so they must have come back and thought, huh, well, how did that happen?
Yeah.
It's a miracle.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So she is a pretty amazing person. So she is the only one of these five that married again. And she probably did it because the letter that Captain Scott wrote to her from the tent. In the letter, he started writing it and he wrote, "To my wife." And halfway through the letter, he crossed it out and wrote, "To my widow."
So, Oh my gosh.
Oh no.
Can you imagine getting that letter in the end? Anyway, no. But anyway, he wrote it and he said, I'm trying to remember because it would be great if I could quote it, but I'm not sure I can do it exactly. But he said, "I don't entertain any sentimental rubbish about remarriage. When the right man comes along to help you in life, you should feel, you know, free to marry." Anyway, so she did. I mean, everybody was in love with her. But she chose this politician who had lost an arm in the war. And he was a very nice man. And then she had Wayland Kennett with him. When she was in her mid-40s. And because she was quite old, particularly for that time, she thought perhaps she might die giving birth to this child. And so she wrote to Peter, her son with Captain Scott, she wrote a letter saying, "Dear little darling, if I die, then, you know, I don't know whether you can see people after you die, but just in case I can, I want to see you, you know, merry and happy and playing around and working hard." And she basically wrote the letter to Peter that her husband had written to her.
Oh,
God. Quite amazing. But yeah. But she survived the, you know, and that time she had chloroform. And this is because, you know, she hadn't the first pregnancy because it sort of wasn't, you know, reliable enough. But because there was a decade between, you know, science had advanced a bit. Anyway, the thing that I think is really interesting is that a woman, you know, in having a man's baby, you are creating a kind of name for them. Literally at that time, they took their father's name. So Peter Scott had, you know, she had created a name for Scott. So that's a physical, biological name. But then she authorised an excerpt in the paper that said, Captain Scott's just had Peter, but this will make no difference to his plans for going to the South Pole, because he was going to go and make his reputation, his name. So she can make his biological name. He still has to make his reputation. But also, you know, at that time particularly, you know, childbirth was a risky business. So she was also risking her life, making a name for him, wasn't she? Wow. And I think that female experience, I've always wanted to write a birth story, because I think it just hasn't been written about in a way that I recognise. I've had three children. You know, it's an extraordinary experience. And so yes. I was so keen to be able to write that into this, her story. Mm-hmm. And so I did. Mm-hmm. I did write the last, because Kathleen Scott wrote about it in very clear detail. She walked, when she knew she was having contractions, she walked to that statue we've talked about in Waterloo Place, you know, to Scott. And I kind of wonder why. She, you know, it wasn't his baby, but she was still kind of drawing inspiration and you know, strength from him. And so on the way back, she, you know, she could hardly walk because she was having contractions.
Oh my gosh.
And then, it's amazing, isn't it? So the last chapter of all of these women's lives, I've called The Worst Journey, using the title of Cherry's book, which is about the winter journey actually in that Antarctic expedition. But I've used that title. So every woman's worst journey. And so for her, walking back from that statue having contractions is the worst journey.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes, in the end, you know, she did, she had Wayland, and I met him and talked to him. So then that was a really wonderful thing to be able to, you know, meet somebody who actually knew her. So, so that's sort of, you know, her story is that she goes on to have another child and another life. And she actually became Lady Kennet. So she became Lady Scott after Scott died. And then totally separately, she became Lady Kennet when her husband was knighted for another reason. So she married these lions quite deliberately.
It's, yeah.
You know, she selected them. At the time, Leonard Darwin, so Darwin's son, had been head of the Royal Geographic Society. And the idea about inherited genes was very, very strong. So she deliberately chose Captain Scott as the father for her son. And she said, I've been looking for the father for my son all my life. And this is the man. And then there's an amazing bit where she said, you know, when I met him, I wasn't in love with him. I just knew that basically he had the right genes. But when we'd had a child together, I suddenly fell in love with him for the first time. Isn't that an amazing thing? Amazing admission.
Mm-hmm. And that's good, though, that she did fall in love with him.
Yeah, she did.
She didn't hate him or something.
No, it's the most extraordinary situation. Anyway, so there you go. That's Kathleen. Has that given you enough of a kind of insight into her? She's an extraordinarily complex woman.
Yeah, she sounds super interesting complex.
Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So then the next one is probably Oriana Wilson. She was married to the head of the scientific staff, Dr. Edward Wilson, who is known as Bill. Both of them were very religious, and he had qualified as a medic doctor, but he had been sort of invalided off the course because he had tuberculosis, and he'd had to go to Switzerland to sanatoria to survive. And at the time, there wasn't a cure, so they didn't know if he would survive. So anyway, when he came back from that, Oriana and him had met at a missionary sort of school in Battersea, because at the time, students, particularly medical students, in their holidays used to go and work for missionaries. And in Battersea, which is now a very smart area of London, that used to be a sort of slum area. So they met there. And so when she first met him, he was a very healthy, you know, robust medical student with a future as a doctor, which would have, you know, been quite a reasonable place in society. And she instantly fell in love with him, but didn't admit it. And he was planning sort of to be able to go off probably to Africa and be a missionary. And so they met, and I can imagine there was this amazing electricity when they first met. Anyway, then he excused himself to go upstairs to study because he was staying in this place. She was just visiting. And she was an amazing pianist. She could just listen to a tune and play it and sing along as well. So she then played the piano and sang along to it. But because he had said that he had gone upstairs, he couldn't then compliment her the next day, because then she'd know that he'd come down the stairs to listen.
Oh,
which is what he actually did. So years later, he said, I was just behind the door, you know.
Oh.
So that's quite lovely, isn't it? They were very, very in love with each other. But anyway, so when he got ill, he didn't ask her to marry him because he didn't know if he was going to survive. So off he went to this sanatorium, and they became sort of pen pals, and they wrote a lot to each other. And then eventually his mother said to him, you know, you seem to be seeing a lot of Oriana, you know, when are you going to kind of do the honourable thing and ask her to marry? And there's this extraordinary letter that is quoted in Dr. Edward Wilson's father was also a doctor, and he wrote, after his son's death, he hand wrote a biography of his son. It's done with such love. It's the most incredible document. Anyway, he wrote that the first reaction of his son to saying, are you going to marry Oriana, is saying, you know, of course not. This is a platonic relationship. You know, I feel incredibly close to her. She's a wonderful friend, but this is absolutely not what I'm doing. Anyway, then he went back to London to go and work in a hospital in Battersea, and immediately got ill And then he came back to Cheltenham to be able to, where they lived, to be able to get fresh air. And it instantly asked her to marry him. And then he wrote her and said, you know, it's an amazing thing, love at first sight. And so he, you know, but he hadn't admitted it to that point.
Yeah, it's, a bit of denial.
It'd taken him all that time and all that sort of floating around sanatorium. But you see, then they got engaged and he was an amazing ornithologist. And his father introduced him to a chap called Dr. Slater, who was a collector of birds. Dr. Slater was also involved with the Royal Geographical Society and had heard about this trip to the Antarctic, the first one. So he said to Edward Wilson, you should apply because you're a doctor, you're an artist, you're an ornithologist, you're three men in one, you'd only have to take one you and then get all this research. And he said, but I, you know, I can't possibly do that. I'm, you know, engaged to be married and I'm going to be a doctor and, you know, probably a GP and live in Cheltenham and, you know, have a family. And anyway, he told Oriana that this had happened. And I kind of tried to imagine that moment. What would it have been like? She thinks she's going to settle down to be a doctor's wife. And then suddenly her husband might be going off to the equivalent of Mars, not just the moon. At that time, it was so unmapped. Anyway, so Edward Wilson, they discussed it. They decided it might be God telling him to do that. So he went down to London, had an interview with Scott. Scott basically said, yes, I'd like you to come. And then he walked out of the interview room and then he realised that he hadn't been honest about his tubercular scarred lungs. So he went back into the interview room and he said to Scott, actually, I'm not sure that you would want to take me because I've got scarred lungs and I have had tuberculosis. And Scott said, I want to take you whatever, because, you know, he immediately trusted him. But so he said, so you'll have to come on your own risk. You know, I can't guarantee you'll come back, but you'll have to, if you want to come, I would take you. So then Oriana was waiting in Cambridge to marry him. Literally, she had her wedding dress ready. The church was booked. They were just waiting for the answer from Scott. And so he telegrammed her and said, I'm going to go. And he said, let's get married anyway. So then he took the train up to Cambridge and they got married and he left 3 weeks later.
Wow.
With Scott to the Antarctic. Dang. Isn't it incredible?
Oh, gosh. So they were barely married. Yeah.
Well, barely married.
They've been together for a while before.
Yeah. I would still be pretty annoyed if my husband left 3 weeks after we got married.
3 weeks afterwards. So at that stage, she didn't go out to New Zealand with the ship to see him off. She waved goodbye to him from the Isle of Wight, basically. And then she, interestingly enough, she then got pneumonia. And her mother had died of pneumonia. So actually, you know, It's interesting. The men leave and they don't know whether they're going to come back, but they also don't know whether the women are going to be there. Yeah. So anyway, he did come back and she went out to New Zealand to meet him. And it's a fantastic story because the Terra Nova comes back and it's a gorgeous sunny day, flat, calm sea. And it comes back under steam and Oriana is on one boat looking across at him. She hasn't seen her husband for more than 3 weeks of their marriage until she sees him sailing in. And from the first expedition, he did come back. And he said, this kind of meeting beats a wedding hollow. It's the most incredibly powerful experience. And he said, she looked not a day earlier and far more beautiful.
They are so cute.
Yeah. So that's really lovely, isn't it? So they had an amazing marriage. But then because he'd become such a fantastic friend of Scott's, later Scott asked him to go back to the Antarctic. And, you know, he said to her, which I always think is a bit tough, he said to her, I can't bear to think that you would fail me. I must go back with Scott. I can't let him go alone. And I think, well, you know, there's failure, isn't there? And what about her? Anyway, so he did. In the intervening time, she became his scientific assistant and they studied why red grouse were dying on a Scottish moor. And they compiled an incredible piece of research. So in that intervening time between the two expeditions, she learned how to dissect grouse, how to do scientific analysis, you know, how to preserve things, lots and lots of amazing science. So that was like a kind of training for her. They never were able to have children. Neither of them knew why. Maybe it was because she had a very difficult relationship with food. She was probably anorexic. He had had all this strange treatment for tuberculosis. You know, at that time, that was extraordinary stuff like lithium and lead and all that stuff. So neither of them knew why. They both came from very big families, but they weren't able to have children. So anyway, the second time he went out, she accompanied him all the way to New Zealand. And then when he didn't come back, she then worked for the New Zealand War Office during the war, because she'd been waiting for him in New Zealand for so many years that she'd actually made amazing friends in New Zealand and even thought of emigrating. You know, she really liked it there. And she'd become assigned historian rights. So during the war, she was a fantastic organiser and an inspiring... These women were widows before the rest of the world were widows. You know, they were the five widows. Then there were so many people widowed by the war.
Yeah.
So they were the archetypal widows. They were the people look to for a role model. Anyway, so she was given a CBE after the war, and then the Natural History Museum asked her to become a collector for them. So then she also became a scientist in her own right and had some species named after her.
Whoa! But
isn't it amazing? But she sent some species that she preserved back from Australia, and the Natural History Museum got them, put them in a drawer, and then, you know, because she burned all her letters to him and she foregrounded him in all the stories about the pole, everyone's forgotten about her. But she was actually a CBE and a scientist, a recognised scientist. So I found these bats in a drawer. They're still there in the Natural History Museum in London. You can ask to see them. But, you know, nobody had seen them. I hope that they one day will go on display, because when, in the worst journey in the world, when those three men went to collect penguins' eggs, those penguin eggs are the most visited exhibit in the Natural History Museum. Because that's the Scott Polar story is so famous, but nobody realised that just a kind of couple of yards away there is this drawer with Oriana's preserved species in. So that's quite gives you an idea of how invisible they were. And how visible the men have always been.
You can discover a species, and
it's quite a visual metaphor, isn't it, for how it's been. So then shall I go on to Lois Evans? So she's the third wife. And so Lois is the only working class wife. So Lois was born in Gower, which is a part of South Wales. And they spoke English, but they went to church in the north of that peninsula, which is a very small sort of bit that juts out at the bottom of Wales. They spoke Welsh and they were chapel, and neither of the two communities spoke to each other. So if the vicar from their church English-speaking community at the bottom of that peninsula gave a girl from the chapel Welsh-speaking side of the peninsula a lift in his pony cart, he would give her a lift and be perfectly civil, but they wouldn't speak. Isn't that incredible? Shows you that these people didn't travel. You know, it was a very small rural community. Lois... Taff was her cousin. Her husband was also her cousin, and they grew up together in this community, and they learned to read and write, and so they were much more educated than their parents. And Lois had a very wonderful singing voice, and so the rector, who was the sort of most educated person in the community, took her into his house, and she learned to sing alongside his daughter. So Lois was given a kind of insight into how middle-class people lived, and their sort of expectation of secondary education and their sort of manners and etiquette and all that sort of thing. Anyway, she became an amazing singer, and so locally in South Wales, she was often asked to sing. So, for example, if a kind of national star was going to sing somewhere and they couldn't turn up because of weather or the roads, because there were only dirt tracks to the place where she lived, she was asked to step in. So she often had these...
Wow.
She was singing. And so she was a very small lady. I think that Taff was 14 stone and very strongly built. You know, and his neck was as wide as his head. He could pick up two men at a time. You know, it was amazing. So he could literally pick Lois up in one hand. But they were an amazing couple, I think. And she was very discreet. And so I think they must have had an understanding when they were very young that they were going to marry each other. And Taff, her husband, went to the Navy, and then Scott chose him as the person he wanted to take on the first discovery expedition. So he had already been to the Antarctic. When he came back, he was interviewed by a newspaper, and they said, you know, so here you are now, a kind of national hero. Are you thinking, do you have any plans to get married? And he said, no. And exactly. But the thing is that it showed that Lois had never betrayed the fact that they had this understanding. That is how discreet she was. She was in her kind of late 20s, quite old for a person in her community to get married, but she'd just kept this secret. And so a couple of days after that interview, they got married. And they were the sort of celebrity couple of their era. And she had this picture hat and a silk chiffon dress. And, you know, everybody turned out for the wedding. There were crowds of people. Mm-hmm. And after the wedding, they had two sittings, because Lois sort of grew up in a pub called The Ship Inn, and they had two sittings. So they, you know, this enormous display of generosity to all their guests, because they were such a popular couple. She was very popular and known to be a singer. He was very popular. He was an Antarctic hero. Mm-hmm.
Do you know why he wanted to keep it a secret?
Well, I'm not sure why they waited, but I think that she just believed that he would come back and he would marry her. So it's kind of amazing, mm-hmm. really. Because she was very beautiful. She was a very sought after lady in you know, lots of other people wanted to marry her, but she just never told people why she wasn't getting married. And I imagine that he was trying to be discreet. He was quite suspicious of reporters. At one point he said, "You're not going to make this into an advert, are you?" You know, and it's quite interesting. So he was very much sort of towing the party line. And talking about the expedition in the kind of way that Captain Scott would want him to. So I think he just didn't want to have that focus on his, you know, marital status. That was probably why. But anyway, so they went to, when they left after the meal after their service, the Coast Guards all fired fireworks into the air, and the farmers all let off their guns. Called a fair de joie, it's called, you know. And so there's this, you can imagine this couple on a pony cart, very kind of modest working class couple, but they were just mega heroes in their community, going on their pony cart all the way across South Wales to be able to get to the train with these fireworks going off all around them, all the way. It was rather lovely. Uh-huh. Anyways, so they went to Portsmouth, and they lived in a house in Portsmouth, and they had three children. But it is rather a complicated story, because when Lois was pregnant with the second child, Taff had a relationship with a teacher a couple of streets away, and she became pregnant with twins.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And I imagine, it's amazing, isn't it? But I imagine that Lois probably must have known about it, because it was only two streets away. And because this woman put P.O., you know, Edgar Evans on the child's birth certificate. So it's a quite an extraordinary story, isn't it, that? Because, you know, they did go on to have another child, but you know that expression, a sailor has a wife in every port.
But these are two in one port.
That's precisely what I imagine her thinking. Exactly. So it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Also, after she waited for him all that time, she was so loyal and discreet. And oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. And it's quite interesting thinking about that story, because there's another one which we'll come to with Caroline Oates. But they used to have things called bastardy tithes. So if it could be proved that a man had, you know, had a child out of wedlock, he might be required to give an allowance to the mother of his illegitimate child. And, you know, I don't know whether Taff's salary auntie's allowance was also split to her. I don't know how public this situation was, because they didn't write about it. But I just wonder, particularly once Lois was given part of the Mansion House Fund, which was formed from the outpouring of public sympathy after the tragedy. I wonder whether Beatrice, the other woman, you know, might have asked for a section of that allowance. Or whether the press found out who she was, and because she had, you know, the name was on the child's birth certificate, so it would be traceable in our day and age, it would be traceable. So I just don't know, but I have spoken to Sharon Holder, who is the daughter of, so she is the granddaughter of the child. So the child, the Beatrice had twins. One of the twins died, but the other one grew up and had a daughter, and then that daughter had a son. And she didn't tell her son, and after she died, the aunt told the son, "Do you know that your grandfather was Taff Evans?" So the Lois Evans's story is different in that it got to the point where she had to earn money. So then when I try to look into her story, I was trying to look at how women would have earned money in Portsmouth. And this is another thing that's quite interesting for when you write your biography, that in the census form, it has Lois and it has her three children. And beside Lois in pencil, not in pen, the rest of the census form is filled in pen, it has in brackets shipwright. Now, I know that there were no female shipwrights until after the war, so I doubt that Lois was a shipwright. So how did she earn money? But also, I find myself looking at a census form, and because of what I know about Lois, because I know that she was incredibly impoverished, you know, when Taft's allowance failed, I have to say that I don't believe that census form. That's kind of a weird thing to do as a biographer. When I'm looking at archive material, I'm also having to look at it with what else I know about the context and decide whether I believe that having shipwright next to Lois's name, because she could have survived if she was a shipwright, she would have had a salary. But she self-evidently didn't have a salary, or she wouldn't have been almost starving. So isn't that quite interesting when you're looking at non-fiction, how you have to judge the evidence? Anyway, so... So she probably, well, her cousin, Will Tucker, came and said, "You're coming to live with me." So she went back. And the way that I've looked at Lois's life is through voice recordings, because there really wasn't much written material then. And they didn't think that any of their documents were worth preserving. But somebody went round South Wales and tried to record the accent and the Welsh names for things and their traditions. And so they ended up, because Lois was related to a lot of people in South Gower, they ended up interviewing Lois's cousins and uncles and aunts and things. And so from that, I've sort of pieced together how her life would have been. And one of her cousins says, you know, there was no real poverty on Gower, because you could, you know, if you wanted food, you grew it. In Portsmouth, you couldn't do that. It was, you know, Portsmouth was mostly sort of paved and tarmac, and people earned their money in different ways. So if she went back to Gower, they had a family pig. Then you know that. Then I know which part of the sort of killing of the pig the women were involved in. So part of the way I try to work this story is that I have something happening in the southern hemisphere with the men, and I try to make an echo of the story in the northern hemisphere. So in the southern hemisphere, the men have to butcher the ponies, because the ponies are a wasting asset, as Scott calls them. And so you have this kind of abattoir in the snow, just the whole snow covered in blood when they butcher the ponies. And then if you look at the northern hemisphere, there is also Lois Evans having to help with killing the family pig, because that's how they got meat. So I try to kind of make an echo of these sort of stories in the north and south hemisphere, to try and kind of keep this narrative going between the two hemispheres with people that couldn't communicate with each other. So that was a hell of a challenge. So that's sort of how it worked. But also, it's quite interesting, she probably tried to work in a pub in Portsmouth, but at the time, married women weren't allowed to have a license to run a pub, because they were supposed to be looking after the family. But what if the breadwinner had died? They still weren't.
Yeah, this is like an impossible situation. It's like, oh.
They were in completely in catch 22, these women. They really were. And so the other options in Portsmouth for work were the corsetry business, which was very big. You could do it at home, so you didn't need to go out to work. And and women, not Lewis, I don't think, but used to feed their children laudanum to make them quiet enough for them to be able to carry on, you know, their business of sewing, because that's how they earn money. Because they couldn't pay for childcare and work. I mean, we still have the same situations. Yeah. It's interesting,
that's
isn't it?
What you gotta do.
Yeah,
and I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure they didn't know like how dangerous it could be to like give a baby or a small child. Like,
they just didn't have an option. They couldn't. They couldn't work either. Otherwise. So it's quite interesting. There's definitely this, you know, stakes were guessing. And the last way she could have earned money is if she had carried on with her career as a singer. But at the time, you know, people sort of frowned on actresses. They were considered to be just shy of sort of being prostitutes. So, you know, she would have damaged Taff's reputation if she had sort of taken to the stage. So, she, you know, she really was completely in a catch-22, basically. So she went back to Wales. So the amazing thing is, when the message comes back to say that Taff has died, the Admiralty get the telegram to be sent to Portsmouth, because they don't even know that she has moved back to Wales, that she couldn't survive.
Oh, no.
So then the message is taken back by the telegram boy to the Portsmouth office. Then they then they send it to Wales. By that time, the newspaper has already heard. So the first person that tells her that Taff has died is the newspaper reporter.
Oh, gosh. Oh, no. So tragic.
It's just so sad. All the ways these women found out, like, this super intimate information, like, just from, like, a third party. Like, it's so crazy.
It's a crazy thing. But I must carry on with the women, if you'd like me to.
Yes.
Shall I carry on with their biographies? Caroline Oates was one of the mothers. She was the daughter of a very successful engineer who started a business sort of from scratch. She was an amazing entrepreneur. So she was very wealthy, and she married her cousin, who was a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society. He had been on expeditions to South America and South Africa with his brother. And they were very into the arts and crafts. They commissioned stained glass windows and paintings, and she went to the opera a lot. She was very sort of cultured, and she had a very funny relationship with her son. Captain Oates was very witty, and she was determined to make him smart and to make him very sort of cultured. So he went to Othello, and he wrote to her. I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, "It was very good, but I didn't enjoy it very much."
Okay. Honest.
Honest, exactly. So the way into Kathleen Oates is really through seeing her accounts book. She was her father's daughter in that she was meticulous about keeping her accounts and balancing her books. She ran this mega business of this entire village, plus three sets of servants, you know, and it's quite interesting because Captain Oates was, we would now say dyslexic, but that term wasn't coined at the time. So he failed all his exams, but she pulled strings and she talked to the wives of the generals to be able to get him a position in the army. So it's quite interesting seeing the power of the women behind the scenes, you know, the power behind the throne.
And kind of like networking.
Networking, massive networking. Because all of these women, they were the keepers of the flame. After the men died, they were in control of the story. They had more power over the story than any of the men. And it was the biggest story of the time. It was a kind of foundational story. It was a story that affected the First World War, because it affected how people were able to kind of go over the top and lead from the front, and self-sacrifice and courage, all those kind of formative things. And so they were incredibly powerful. So Kathleen Scott edited Captain Scott's diary to try and take out the parts that she felt didn't reflect well on the expedition or him. Mm-hmm. Oriana probably erased some of the pencil marks of her husband's diary. So you have these words and then blank lines where she edited, literally edited it. So his life is the one that we have received that she allowed, you know, the words she allowed to get through. Anyway, and so Caroline Oates was the most protective over Oates's legacy. She was asked whether he had a diary of to the South Pole, and she said he didn't, and it was a lie. So she refused to cooperate with any posthumous biographies of him, and she told her youngest child, Violet Oates, that when she died, she wanted Violet to burn the diaries and the letters, and she trusted her to do that because she'd obeyed her mother all her life. Anyway, Caroline Oates died, and as I said, she died embittered, feeling that Scott had killed her son, and she felt the emphasis was so much on his death rather than his life. She felt that was the ultimate tragedy. Anyway, so that's the Caroline Oates story. So the last woman is Emily Bowers. Emily Bowers is interesting because all the other people were born into the class that they stayed in. But Emily Bowers was the daughter of a tailor in Cheltenham. And she sewed an amazing, beautiful crinoline dress. And I think of it rather like she was a chrysalis and she sewed herself to be a butterfly. And she was very bright and she got a scholarship and the Queen's Certificate. So a lot of people failed the Queen's Certificate because they were being taught at home by governesses, you know, in the kind of middle to upper classes. But Emily was, you know, took the Education Act seriously and she really sort of learned as much as she possibly could, got a scholarship, went to be a teacher, and within a couple of years of the first school she went to, she was made headmistress. All of the Bowers were exceptional. I kind of talk about it like a Midas touch. They didn't look much. You know, we were just Emily was pretty well built, and so was Birdie, her son. And so, you know, she's a lovely kind of character. So she was extremely bright. And so was her son. And when Dr. Edward Wilson first met him, you know, he saw this sort of short, red-haired, fairly chubby chap with an amazing hooked nose, which is why he's called Birdie. He said, there's not much in the shop window, but what a shop. You know, because he was the most incredible chap. Captain Scott said, I can give him any list of figures, any amount of data, any task, and it will be accomplished perfectly. He doesn't make mistakes. So when Birdie first went out with Scott to the pole, he was only going to be in the ship party. He was going to come down to the Terra Nova, drop the real explorers off, and then go back to New Zealand and wait, and then come in again when the sea ice melted with supplies, then go back again, you know, that kind of thing. And on the way out to New Zealand, Captain Scott realised that this was the most incredible man. And so he swapped him for another man and said, you're coming with me to the South Pole.
Oh, wow.
So quite an interesting situation if you were the mother of that. You see, when you first let him go off to the South Pole, you're thinking, well, he's not going to go to the South Pole. He's only going to go into Antarctica and then back to New Zealand, which is perfectly safe. It's an, you know, it's sort of outreach of the empire. I know that because she had taught in Malaysia. But then on the way out, Scott swaps him and he gets into this role where he might risk his life, really. So how do you feel about that if you're the mother?
I feel like, excuse me, I did not agree to this.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But it's a mother-son relationship, you know, they're both adults. But actually, the story goes further back than that, because part of what we've been discussing is communication. And they got quite superstitious because, you know, you can be telepathic maybe over distances, even if you can't send a radio message. You can think, why am I feeling like this? Is something happening to them?
Yeah.
You know, something like that. So when Emily Bowers said goodbye to her son at Waterloo Station for him to go off and get on the Terra Nova and go down to New Zealand with Scott, she had this terrible feeling of presentiment. She felt that she was never going to see him again. She just had this crushing, terrible second sight that this was goodbye.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that is so sad.
Isn't that extraordinary? And she was right. Yeah. She was right.
I mean, I guess in some ways, at least she got to say goodbye then.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah.
It's very difficult, isn't it? This thing. Do you live in hope, permanent hope? Mm-hmm. Or do you try to be realistic and think they're taking a massive risk with their life? I'm going to say goodbye as if it is the final time, in case it is. How do you do that? That's what I kind of want to be the sort of takeaway from this book. What would you have done? Because, okay, it's 110 years ago and it's a foreign country as far as the kind of morals and the class system and the ways that people parent and wives and suffrage and all that. But we're still all women and we still have relationships. You know, we're the same. We all have the same heart.
Yeah.
The biology of it hasn't changed. You know, so that's all the same. So you should be able to put yourself in their shoes and think, what would I do? Which of these five women can I relate to, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, that's thank incredible. You so much. I feel like I've learned so much. not just about like the individual women, but about communication, which I didn't realize like that was such a like thread in your biography, but I can see like how important it is, like in every aspect of like their relationships and lives. That's really interesting. And yeah, like just the fact that so many of these people, like you've met like the son of one of them, like it feels like so foreign and far away, but like it's still around us. Like it's not actually that far away.
No, it isn't at all. Absolutely. Yeah. And I met Oriana's niece in a care home. Obviously these people are very old, but it isn't extraordinary that I just kind of caught it just before the people who had met them died, because it's 100 years. That's a bracket of generations, isn't it? So quite interesting as well. If your biography idea is rejected, that doesn't mean to say you should stop researching it, because perhaps those subjects will be vital to a biography which will become a kind of, you know, a mainstream theme.
Yeah. Or maybe it'll be like, you know, changes things and sets the pace and makes people...
I wonder. My plan was just to try and tell those stories with as much integrity as I possibly could and as much kind of vitality, so that you really sort of feel as if you've lived them a bit. That was my plan, rather than a sort of disinterested academic scholarly biography. So as Emily Bowers said, you know, to try and make it too readable. So I want you to be able to be completely involved in it as if it was a film, as if it's happening in front of your eyes.
Thank you guys so much for coming back and listening to part two of the Snow Widows episode with Catherine McInnes. Just a reminder, you can learn more about Snow Widows on snowwidows.co.uk, and you can buy the book on uk.bookshop.org. And you can also follow Catherine on Instagram at McInnes.Catherine. We are also going to have a little bonus episode for you guys next week, with some extra material from our interview with Catherine, just going into more details of the Snow Widow story. So keep an eye out for that. And thanks for listening.
This is Sistery.